It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Reverend Ricky Burgess has represented Pittsburghers in Council District 9 for nearly a dozen years. His seat is up for re-election this year, and with the Democratic majority in this city and that district, it will essentially be decided in the May primary. Councilman Burgess joins us in studio now. Reverend Burgess, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Two individuals have declared their candidacy in Council District 9. Activist, police shooting survivor Leon Ford, former school board member Randall Taylor. You declared your candidacy directly to WESA yesterday. Why do you want four more years?
Well, I believe that we need to work together as a city, and in my district, work together as communities. We've had some real successes from economic development, such as Larmer and Homewood and Garfield. In addition, that's made the city stronger. We've helped make the city safer by the Group Violence Initiative and the Maryland Lethality Assessment Model. So they say this is the lowest violence we've had in the last 14, 15 years. And so I believe my work's not done. I think there's more work to do. And so I look forward to working with community organizations and residents to give them the power to rebuild and restore their communities.
Right. So what do you want to build upon the accomplishments, or something that hasn't been done yet? What do you want to accomplish?
In terms of development, the project that I'm working on now that I'm most excited about is linking North Point Breeze to Homewood. There is a project, the Old Lexington Technology Center, the parking lot's going to be redone into 150 housing units of mixed income housing. What we hope to do is take another phase and come straight down Homewood Avenue to have a real Bridging the Westway project. And down Homewood Avenue, we hope to build new housing that'll have first floor retail and second and third apartments, and almost overnight rebuild the Homewood Business District and give support and financial support to African-American entrepreneurs and others who want to be in this new business district. I am extraordinarily excited by that possibility, but I will continue to help to working with community groups to rebuild communities to have certainly much more affordable housing. There's a new project on Hamilton Avenue going up of residential housing. I think we need more home ownership. We just need to continue this development activity. At the same time, I will continue my efforts with the police. We've, as you know, involved with the Stop the Violence model now. And so we will, starting February, start hosting these quarterly community meetings. We have a monthly executive committee that meets downtown, and that's sort of the city officials, and we will now work with community groups and interested individuals. It takes really a whole community to make it better, and you need more than housing. You need better schools. You need it to be safe. You need economic development. You also need jobs, and so I want to continue making our community stronger, safer, and more secure.
You used a couple of words. You used bridge and linking. How much of it is physical linking connection, and how much is this also maybe an attitude of making these communities linked?
Well, there's a model that we use called the HELP Initiative. We follow a five-step process of doing economic development and community development in our district. Even though it's been piloted in our district, the city loves it, and we think it's going to be replicated throughout the city. And the five steps are this. The first thing is we help coordinate collaboration. We bring community groups and individuals together into one collaborative. The second thing that we do then is do comprehensive community planning so they can have a shared vision of their future. The third thing is bringing capacity community-based organizations so they can participate in lead development activities and community rebuilding. Four is certainly capital, raise the money so that you can do all of these interventions. And last but not least is the actual construction of new neighborhoods. That model is in five neighborhoods right now: East Liberty, East Hills, Lincoln Limington, Larmer, Homewood. HELP comes from those anachronism of those things. HELP Initiative is the protection initiative. And so it's to protect those communities so that the indigenous people can stay there, even though we will bring in new people. The goal is to take communities of concentrated poverty and transform them into stable, successful, mixed-income communities.
In the past, you've outlasted crowded fields in the last couple of elections. Do multiple challengers benefit you? In other words, candidates splitting the voters who don't vote for Reverend Ricky Burgess.
So I spent all my, I've been a pastor in that community for 35 years. I'm from Homewood. I met my wife in the first grade from Homewood, right? So I just focus on trying to get every voter and every vote, and I work to, in terms of campaigning, I simply take my message directly to the voters, and hopefully my record speaks for itself, and I look forward to continuing to work with them if it's their choice. I'm a servant, whether it's at church or at school or at council. My job is to serve both the God who I serve and the people who I love.
One of the candidates, one of your challengers, Leon Ford, has touted his listening tour. He told The Confluence back in December that one reason he wanted to run is because your office isn't always receptive to hearing from constituents and that you aren't easy to talk to. How do you respond to that?
I think that trying to do big ticket items, right? We were able to do the Larmer Choice, which is 400 new houses, building a new low rise in Homewood, building a neighborhood in Garfield, doing Lexington and hopefully Homewood Avenue. Doing these big ticket items takes a lot of time and attention. I think at the same time, it's really very important to do constituent services. We've been having a round of community meetings over the last 3 months. I think I've been in 7 or 8 communities. And so we've had great meetings. It's been with the city officials. We've had representatives from the police, from public safety, from public works, from the URA, from the housing authority. And we have specifically tried to meet the needs of the residents who have attended those communities. And it's been interesting. All my communities, like I said, it's very diverse. They're all very different. And in Stanton Heights, the primary interest is in deer, of all things. Their deer population is their major concern. But if you go to a place like Larmer, their concern is housing development and jobs. And so it's an eclectic district, but we are grateful to have the opportunity to serve them and to together have, we believe, made some significant strides to rebuilding those communities.
Randall Taylor, one of the challengers, told WESA that Pittsburgh elected officials don't do enough to rein in developers who he says are allowed to do whatever they want, and residents become collateral damage. Are your constituents losing homes to development, and what can you do? What are you doing to prevent that?
Well, if you look at the HELP initiative, if you look through the 5 steps, the second step is comprehensive planning. So we get the residents to decide what they want their community to be. The reason it's called the protection initiative is because it actually empowers the residents to lead development in their own community. In the next couple of weeks, in fact, the URA will be releasing RFPs to build 2 new mixed-income housing in East Liberty. The Village Collaborative, which is a new collaborative of faith-based leaders in East Liberty, will be guiding that process. We're hoping that that will build about 200 new mixed-income housing units along with retail. And these are on Beatty Street. And so they're like a block from where Penn Plaza used to be. And so it will fulfill the promise that the mayor and I made a couple years ago that everyone in Penn Plaza who wanted to come back will have a place to come back to.
In December, you and your colleague, Dan Lavelle, unveiled a Stop the Violence initiative. You said, quote, "We need a variety of activities to address violence in District 9, be it from gang members, one-on-one violence, domestic violence, and even police officer-related violence." What resources do you need?
Well, okay, a couple things. I have been working on violence reduction stuff even before I was a member of council. It's been something that I've been having been a pastor in Homewood, which in fact where my church is at one time was considered one of the most dangerous places in Allegheny County and one of the most dangerous places in the country. And so I've been always concerned about it. As you may or may not know, my family has been affected by violence. I've had shootings in my family, my mother-in-law was shot and killed. My wife's grandfather died by gun violence. My cousins were shot and killed. Members of my church were shot and killed. My aunt was murdered by gun violence. My mother had a nervous breakdown from which she never recovered. Gun violence is personal for me, right? So I spent a lifetime trying to figure out how to make this better. And certain you need all the other amenities. You need better communities. You need better schools, better housing, more better jobs. But specifically to do gun violence, you need to do some prevention stuff. And Lavelle and I have put $500,000 a year for the next 5 years to group violence initiative work, which means that you link the police, the community, and social services together to these at-risk, mostly men, who are doing most of the violence. And that program has gotten national awards. And again, it's worked. We're the lowest we've been in 15 years. And so we hope to raise another $500,000 to brings the total to $1 million a year to do these outreach efforts, to do these prevention programs before they shoot, to give them the social services, to give them the education, to give them the access to jobs, also, you know, to do better and smarter policing, and to have these ex-community members, they were once either in the life or understand that lifestyle, and speak as from authority to these kids, telling them that there is no future in doing crime and violence.
Whether you've got 11 months or another 5 years in office, what do you hope your legacy will be in District 9?
To be honest with you, I would hope that they see it, that I have done the best I can to rebuild communities, to strengthen families, and to love people. I would hope that my 35 years as pastor of a church in Homewood and my 27, 28 years now of being a professor at a college and has a branch in Homewood and all the students teaching there, along with my 12 years on council, they will say that I am someone who tried to make life better for families in the communities I represented, and in whatever role, I tried to empower them and help make their lives better.
The Democratic primary for Pittsburgh City Council is May 21st. Reverend Ricky Burgess is a three-term councilman representing District 9, and he is running for a fourth term. Rev, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. This week, West Mifflin served what might be the final blow to Century 3 Mall. The mall was shut down following a pipe break that caused damage and the shutoff of the sprinkler system. Officials deemed it unsafe and uninhabitable. And a city salt truck driver was fired after running into a parked car and never reporting the crash. It happened sometime overnight in January, and the car's owner says the rear driver's side door and taillight were badly damaged. Find more on our website at WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro filed a lawsuit in Commonwealth Court Thursday to keep UPMC from ending its relationship with rival Highmark June 30th. The petition aims to modify the consent decree that allows some Highmark members to have access to in-network UPMC services. WESA's health and science reporter Sarah Bowden was at Shapiro's news briefing. Joins us now. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
So what is Shapiro asking of Commonwealth Court?
Basically, he wants the Commonwealth Court to make UPMC and Highmark negotiate over, accepting each other's clients or consumers for insurance. And then if that doesn't work, then he would want both entities to go to baseball arbitration.
So
baseball arbitration is both sides make a deal and then the arbitrator accepts one deal. So there's no mismatch of the deals. It's just one or the other.
I accept Highmark's. I accept UPMC's. Not some
exactly.
Made up. Okay. So what Highmark members would be affected right now by this action, and what Highmark members are currently receiving services that could end June 30th under this consent decree ending?
Well, a lot of people who go to the Hillman Cancer Center, they probably won't be able to continue seeing their doctors if the consent decree expires without anything furthering it. And then there's just a lot of folks that like have doctors or providers in both systems that are currently using an insurance company that allows them to use both providers, which are frankly just so much more expensive for some folks.
Why is Shapiro's suit only targeting UPMC?
Because Highmark has consistently been willing to compromise. And so Shapiro says UPMC is the entity that is making this difficult.
And so this is to nudge them to the negotiating table.
Exactly.
To be clear, is the Attorney General trying to, I'll say, turn back the clock before all the problems started when Highmark got into the healthcare business by acquiring Allegheny Health Network, which is a competitor of UPMC, Hospitals Medical Services, or is it just to extend the services of for those that you just mentioned?
Right. So Shapiro was sort of not clear in what he was saying. On the one hand, he's like, I want to extend the consent decrees that have provided protections to certain groups of patients in perpetuity. But then if you look at the materials and the brief, what he's saying is that he wants to make it so regardless of the insurance carrier, people can have access in network access. So.
Right. Okay. So what does Shapiro, why does he think he has legal standing? What are the grounds for the action?
Basically, he's saying that UPMC isn't acting like a public charity. And it's abusing its tax-exempt status by being in such fierce competition with Allegheny Health Network and Highmark.
So he's questioning whether they're acting like a nonprofit.
He's definitely doing that.
Okay. Very briefly, UPMC's response, anything?
UPMC said that its competition with Highmark has been good for consumers because it's creating more services in Western PA.
But it didn't address the specifics of the suit.
No.
All right. And there are some legislative remedies that are being floated as well, including a constitutional amendment, but that would be well after this deadline.
Yeah, it takes a while to pass a constitutional amendment, so it would take way past June 30th.
Okay. Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks, Kevin.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. A long-standing, gay-owned, gay-operated, and gay-proud nightclub in the Strip District is closing its doors this weekend after one more farewell party. For several years now, Cruise Bar has been a popular gathering spot for the city's younger set of LGBTQ-identifying adults. Did development push the party spot out of the neighborhood, and what will its departure mean for other queer spaces? Joining us to talk about the bar and its place in queer Pittsburgh is Stacey Fedoroff, a freelance journalist who recently wrote about it for The Incline. Welcome, Stacey.
Great to be here, Megan.
And from afar in Tucson, Arizona, we have historian Harrison Apple. They are the co-director of the Pittsburgh Queer History Project, which explores the city's after-hours clubs, mostly through the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. Harrison, thanks so much for getting up early with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Megan.
Stacey, tonight is Cruise's last dance, so to speak, but it's been a long goodbye. What happened? Why has it taken so long to close the doors? And why is Cruise shutting down at all?
I first reported about Cruise closing in September, and I think the major reason why they've delayed the closing a few months was they had got an extension from the developer and the other powers that be to be able to push it back to February. There's a lot of development happening in and around that area of the Strip District, most recently called Robotics Row because of the companies that are coming in there.
The Strip District is a really hot buy right now development-wise. How did that affect the decision?
I think several of the businesses in that building were displaced primarily because of the developer.
A lot of those are other nightclubs, right?
Yes. There were some nightclubs. Costume World was on the corner. A lot of people probably know that from the airbrushed decorations on the outside with the superheroes. That closed in April 2018. And there also was a haunted house in the basement of that building, Terror Town, that, mm-hmm. but that had closed in 2016.
Is it this building itself, it's pretty big, right? What do we have any idea what it's going to be?
It's like a block long, and it's four stories high. It was built in 1921 as the Standard Underground Cable Company, and the developer, McCaffrey Interests, wants to make it ground level retail and then the rest office space, but retain like the windows that you see because it was an industrial warehouse, the exposed brick and the steel beams.
The character of old buildings always makes such a big impression in Pittsburgh. Harrison, did you ever frequent Crews?
I went to Crews a couple of times, mostly for performances, but sometimes as a way to connect people who I was interviewing about past bars and clubs, to reconnect with people who they've maybe not seen for a number of years. Infrequently, but certainly not, it wasn't a stranger to the place.
What kind of place is it? How does it compare kind of in the ecosystem of Pittsburgh queer bars?
Well, that's a tough question, you know, because I think that there's an easy way to think about queer bars, which is that they are all gay-owned or operated, right? Or that they exclusively cater to a, quote, LGBT crowd. But in my own dissertation research and my oral history work, I've found that the sort of binary that we imagine of heterosexual, homosexual, is not always, and it actually is infrequently, kind of the entry ticket to one of those kinds of spaces. I think what Stacey had so well picked up on in the article last year was that the sort of phenomenon of people coming together in those places, regardless of the strictness of their identities being the same or coming to those identities the same way, is really what the prized possession of Crews would be for most people that went there. So as far as Crews in the sort of ecosystem of queer Pittsburgh, though, I think it's important to point out that it was pretty closely associated with the Delta Foundation. It was frequently running large shows. You know, it had a large stage area, so it could put on larger productions. But its going away won't necessarily remove the possibility for a communal space.
The Delta Foundation, of course, has been criticized for catering more to white cis or wealthy men. Stacey, should we be sad about this loss? Is it going to put a big hole in spaces for LGBTQ identifying youth specifically?
Well, it is tougher, at least from my reporting, I found that it is tougher for places to host 18 and over nights between 18 and 21. Because of alcohol, that sort of thing, there are some liability and insurance issues. And so I think that there might be a more of a need for that once Crews isn't there anymore.
That carrying that insurance is a little bit more expensive than maybe some of the more exclusive places can handle.
Right.
Harrison, how does Crews compare to inclusive bars of yore?
As I was saying before, right, there's the question of inclusivity is a little complicated, but I think that picking up on that question about being able to have an 18 and up night is really important. Since Pegasus closed, there weren't a lot of places that were able to hold 18 and up nights. That's a really fond memory for a lot of people who are still around in Pittsburgh. And of course, I get a lot of inquiries from people asking about resources or artifacts about other bars, and as far as people are concerned about how do we preserve memory of these kinds of places, I think that the recent past, places like Pegasus at 818 Liberty downtown, basically the basement of Space Gallery, are going to be familiar, comparable kinds of spaces that were complicated, ambivalent to the promise of, you know, community bringing everyone together, but nonetheless valuable and useful. So it's tough to think about, you know, should we be sad that Crews closes? Yes and no, for multiple reasons. A lot of people won't have a job there anymore. A lot of people who depend on its being a location downtown won't have that resource. But who's to say if there won't be another one soon?
The Eagle on the north side, Holiday in Oakland, also closed. Of course, Pittsburgh still has bars like 5801 in Shadyside, Blue Moon in Lawrenceville, P-Town in North Oakland, and we could maybe even add Mixtape in Garfield to that list. Stacey, in your mind, are these the new harbingers of young gay life in Pittsburgh?
They could be if the bars are still a place that LGBT people want to go. I think that's kind of the good thing about our culture today being more inclusive, the fact that you don't need a physical space or even more of an adult space to gather. You can meet up on a social media group and go to a coffee shop or somewhere else, and then you are automatically, as that group of people, you're making it a queer space.
Yeah,
so you don't need a physical building.
Certainly apps have probably contributed to that conversation as well. Harrison, you're co-director with the Pittsburgh Queer History Project. CMU's Tim Haggerty has opined that maybe this narrative of the death of the gay bar is a little overblown. What do you make of that?
I would generally agree. I think that the difficulty in saying that it's whether or not the gay bar as a concept has died is not necessarily strictly about having access to more places, right? So if the argument is that we speaking for some arbitrary group of people able to occupy public space more safely, you know, I think that's demonstratedly not true by the history of organizing, even in the recent past, like Roots Pride and the more recent People's Pride, demonstrating that, you know, we cannot think of sexuality as having been accepted and therefore producing a safer space. We must take a more intersectional approach to thinking about the ways that racism and classism still change who we think of as the future of Pittsburgh, who belongs here. But as far as gay bars are concerned, you know, sometimes it just comes down to money. And I think that's one of the issues that people have taken aim at Delta for in the past, like we mentioned. So when a bar opens or closes, you know, a lease or an ownership of a building may be gone, but a liquor license is moving around. And so it's a matter of seeing where those things will pop up over and over again. I think that there will always be room for a bar. It's just a matter of where you can get the zoning.
Harrison.
Where you can convince people to go. Sorry.
Yeah, no. What role do you think that gay bars should serve in the public consciousness, whether it's here in Pittsburgh or anywhere?
Well, that's tough, right? Because I don't think I would ever want to take the chance to socially engineer a community. But I think that, you know, bars are complicated spaces. I don't think that they necessarily provide or should provide a particular kind of socially responsible space. I think it's almost an unfair order. But what I do think that they have historically provided is a place for people to congregate, to cross paths, to mix with people that they wouldn't normally see every day. And the historical circumstances of that change all the time. So while I'm, you know, having the chance to do my PhD out in Arizona and coming back and forth between Pittsburgh, I'm getting the mentorship from people who have studied Buffalo and San Francisco and Detroit and seen a very similar case, which is that from every decade on, the way people identify, the way that they identify with each other is radically different based on larger historical consequences.
And Harrison, I know you are in Arizona. Stacey, any chance you'll be there to say goodbye tonight?
I don't know. They had mentioned that their first last event in the fall had a line around the block, so I'm not sure if I will brave the line, but
you said in the coming days though there might be an auction.
I believe there will be an online auction, so if anyone's interested in like maybe taking home a lounge chair from Cruise or the lighted liquor display from behind the bar, I think those will be up for grabs.
Cruise Bar in the Strip District is closing its doors this weekend. Their once and for all closing ball commences tonight. Harrison Apple is an historian based in Arizona. They still co-direct the Pittsburgh Queer History Project. And Stacey Fedoroff is a freelance journalist here in Pittsburgh. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Megan.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Most Pennsylvanians now vote on electronic machines that have no physical record of the vote. That's set to change next year, a victory for critics who say that without paper records, it's impossible to tell if voting totals were altered. But when 90.5 WESA's Chris Potter attended a voting machine expo in Erie, he found replacing the machines could be harder than it looks on paper.
It's a bitterly cold weeknight in Erie, but the first floor of the city library is thronged with visitors, checking out the next generation in voting machines. Some machines look high-tech and fit into briefcases, the kind of device James Bond might use if he were a poll worker. Vendors for other systems, meanwhile, boast about how low-tech their systems are.
In our case, this is the ballot marking device, right here, a pen.
Joe Passarella of Election Systems and Software lets me try out his company's Express Vote, using a sample ballot of fake candidates. His company makes the machines now used in Allegheny and many other counties. The difference with this touchscreen device, and the others displayed here, is that it prints out a paper ballot that's counted when placed into a scanner.
It's going to print your selections on that card. It's going to return it to you, so then you get the opportunity to physically look at your ballots printed out.
The idea is that after election night, poll workers can physically examine it too, to verify the machine counted ballots correctly. While there's no case of a machine's results being tampered with in Pennsylvania, reports of Russian interference in the 2016 election have raised concerns that the digital totals can be hacked. Last year, Governor Tom Wolf's administration issued a requirement that by 2020, all state voting machines must have a paper trail. Counties would need to buy machines approved at both the state and federal level. But questions remain, like the one I asked Passarella.
What does one of these Express Votes cost versus what's this one cost?
We'll quote the county. It's difficult to gauge how many they're going to need in each precinct and everything else.
Even counties that already use paper ballots will have to buy new equipment. And the state's election commissioner, Jonathan Marks, said that statewide, the new machines will cost at least $100 million.
State, federal, and counties all have to work together to fund this so that the counties aren't bearing the entire cost of it. The governor is very committed to secure at least 50% of the funding it would take to procure this voting equipment.
They've got a long way to go. Wolf has about $15 million in federal money on hand, and his new budget requests $15 million more to help buy the machines next year. But there are no guarantees, and 2020 is closer than you think. Allegheny County, for one, spent months training people the last time it bought machines for its 1,300 polling places. County spokeswoman Amy Downs says officials know they're up against the deadline, but they don't know exactly when they'll make a purchase.
We don't have a set time frame, and I think a lot of that has to do with what the funding is going to look like. But we are absolutely 100% aware of the challenges of even just training the public.
Unlike in Erie, Allegheny County hasn't hosted its own open house on voting machines. Downs says that the state is still approving some machines for county use, and officials want voters to have a chance to see them all. But Mary Beth Kuznick, who heads the statewide voting reform group VotePA, is worried the machines still rely too much on digital technology, especially to mark ballots.
The machine takes the voters' choices from the touchscreen and interprets that into a barcode. It counts using the barcode. So there's no way that the voter can be certain that that barcode matches the words that he or she saw on her paper.
Using those codes does speed up counting, though. And in any case, the paper ballots will still be there, with the names the voter selected. Back in Erie, Judge of Elections Michael Butler is optimistic about the future.
We're using paper, and I never thought we'd go back to that, but some of the machines that they're using are doing a real good job. I mean, backup paper and all that.
Butler and others at the Erie event got to take a survey about their favorite system. County officials haven't yet determined a winner, but whatever the outcome, there is a paper trail. I'm Chris Potter, 90.5 WESA News.
And Chris Potter, WESA's Government Accountability and Politics Editor, joins us in studio. Hey, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
Let's start by emphasizing some key points. Counties are required to have the machines in place by when?
By the 2020 presidential election cycle.
Okay. And for Pennsylvania, that primary, I think, is April 28th.
Yeah, sounds right. Yeah.
Okay. But it's recommended they have them in place by?
You don't want to roll out one of these things in a presidential campaign because the turnout's much higher and there's just a lot more scrutiny. Anytime a machine doesn't function, people will freak out about it. So all these counties would prefer to do this sometime in 2019, but it's tricky. There's not a lot of time, and there's concerns like, what if we have one machine in the primary and another machine in the general, and it's just going to be confusion all around.
Right. You want to work out the kinks when the turnout's not so great. And so, but let's face it, is that a possibility? The general election is in November. We're talking not even 9 months now.
Right.
Is it possible?
It seems highly unlikely in most of the counties that I talked to. I've gathered that some counties may be a little closer than others when it comes to making a decision, but very hard to imagine an Allegheny County that hasn't even had the kind of expo that I went to up in Erie yet, because they are waiting for these machines to be certified. There are about a half dozen that we're talking about that were on display when I was up there, a little more than that. Some of them hadn't been fully certified yet, although they're kind of expected to be. So you can't really move on this stuff until you know what machines you've got to kind of work with. And there's always the question, too, of where's the money coming from? As we were just hearing, there's a big question mark about how much money is the state going to be able to provide and how much do the counties have to come up with?
You mentioned about a half dozen. Can counties pick and choose, or is it going to be one across the state?
Nope. The counties, once the machines are certified, the county gets to sort of choose among those machines that get approved by both the federal and the state government. And I have to tell you, I mean, the machines here, they all use paper ballots, but they all kind of incorporate them in different ways. Some are kind of low-tech systems. You just take a ballpoint pen, fill in the oval or put a check on it, you put it through a scanning machine, it gets counted that way. Others, you use a digital touchscreen machine like we use now, and it will print out sort of a paper ballot for you to review, and then either you can scan that yourself manually or the machine will kind of digest the thing it just put out. Right. It's kind of an interesting technology.
So is Pennsylvania behind the times in terms of other states or what?
Pennsylvania is unusual in that there aren't a lot of states where the vast majority of voters use the touchscreen machines like we have. And of course, we're also a swing state that constantly invites a lot of attention in presidential election years. So we are unusual in both of those respects. It's been a concern for a lot of years. I think we're one of 13 states where the majority of voters use those machines.
Okay, so let's get to the cost. I'm sure they vary from model to model, but still it's going to cost really about how much, and where's that money going to come from?
So your average machine that I talk to costs somewhere in the mid 4-digit range. There's a very expensive one, the ES&S XL, which is sort of a big wide screen voting machine that allows you to see the ballot all at once. I'm told that one of those goes for about $7,500. The cheapest of the line are like about half that. But every precinct needs to have some scanner devices. Every precinct does need an electronic machine for people who have disabilities. How much it costs really depends on the machine you buy and how many you need for a polling place. But yeah, the question is, where's the money come from?
Yeah, who's paying?
The state has said, Governor Tom Wolf has said, we would really like to be able to come up with half of the money, get some money also from the feds and have the counties buy in. But it's a very open question about whether the state's going to come anywhere close to that half.
I know that County Executive Fitzgerald told both you and I that there's no money in the budget this year in the county.
That's correct. And that's a big issue, because part of why the state's doing this is they settled a lawsuit with the Green Party. People may remember there were some questions about the Greens about how votes got cast in 2016. That settlement wasn't reached until the end of November. And by that point, budgets are already set for this year. So, yeah, counties are really kind of scrambling.
All right. So final question to you is, all right, you have a paper trail, but are there still concerns that this won't be absolutely secure?
Yeah, I mean, the voting activists who were always concerned about the paperless machines before look at this system and say, hey, some of these machines where the machine prints out the ballot for you as opposed to when you check it off, they use a bar or a QR code. We've all seen these things right on products. And that allows the scanning side of the operation to count those ballots very quickly. But how do you know that what's in your QR, your barcode, is the same thing that you actually pushed, that the words that you wanted to select? There's always going to be questions anytime there's this technology involved, but at least here you've got paper to sort of check when you need to.
So there's a step along the process that could be vulnerable?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the concern, and we'll see how that plays out and which machines the counties buy.
Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government Accountability Team. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority wants to change its agreement with the city because it wants to retain its independence. And we'll talk about promising new anti-rejection drugs for transplant patients. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.